of confounding diagnoses. In the case of Ponlu, what followed was to show that this uncertainty had no consequence. His temperature rose. Throughout the day, the cough grew louder, racking the enfeebled body. At last, at nightfall, Father Ponlu brought up the clot of matter that was choking him. It was red. Even at the height of his fever, Ponlu's eyes kept their blank serenity. And when, next morning, he was found dead, his body drooping over the bedside, they betrayed nothing. Against his name, the index card recorded, "Doubtful Case." All Souls' Day that year was very different from what it had been in former years. True, the weather was seasonable. There had been a sudden change, and the great heat had given place to mild autumnal air. As in other years, a cool wind blew all day, and big clouds raced from one horizon to the other, trailing shadows over the houses, upon which fell again, when they had passed, the pale gold light of a November sky. The first waterproofs made their appearance. Indeed, one was struck by the number of glossy, rubberized garments to be seen. The reason was that our newspapers had informed us that 200 years previously, during the great pestilences of southern Europe, the doctors wore oiled clothing as a safeguard against infection. The shops had seized this opportunity of unloading their stock of out-of-fashion waterproofs, which their purchasers fondly hoped would guarantee immunity from germs. But these familiar aspects of All Souls' Day couldn't make us forget that the cemeteries were left unvisited. In previous years, the rather sickly smell of chrysanthemums had filled the streetcars, while long lines of women could be seen making pilgrimage to the places where members of the family were buried, to lay flowers on the graves. This was the day when they made amends for the oblivion and dereliction in which their dead had slept for many a long month. But in the plague year, people no longer wished to be reminded of their dead, because indeed they were thinking all too much about them as it was. There was no more question of revisiting them with a shade of regret and much melancholy. They were no longer the forsaken to whom one day in the year you came to justify yourself. They were intruders whom you would rather forget. That's why the Day of the Dead this year was tacitly but willfully ignored. As Cottard dryly remarked, Tarrou noted that the habit of irony was growing on him more and more. Each day was, for us, a Day of the Dead. And in fact, the bale fires of the pestilence were blazing ever more merrily in the crematorium. It's true that the actual number of deaths showed no increase, but it seemed that plague had settled in for good at its most virulent, and it took its daily toll of deaths with the punctual zeal of a good civil servant. Theoretically, and in the view of the authorities, this was a hopeful sign. The fact that the graph, after its long rising curve, had flattened out seemed to many, Dr. Richard, for example, reassuring. "The graph's good today," he would remark, rubbing his hands. To his mind, the disease had reached what he called high water mark. Thereafter, it could but ebb. He gave the credit of this to Dr. Castel's new serum, which indeed had brought off some quite unlooked-for recoveries. While not dissenting, the old doctor reminded him that the future remained uncertain. History proved that epidemics have a way of recrudescing when least expected. The authorities, who had long been desirous of giving a fillip to the morale of the populace, but had so far been prevented by the plague from doing so, now proposed to convene a meeting of the medical corps and ask for an announcement on the subject. Unfortunately, just before the meeting was due to take place, Dr. Richard, too, was carried off by the plague. Then precisely at high water mark. The effect of this regrettable event, which, sensational as it was, actually proves nothing, was to make our authority swing back to pessimism as inconsequently as they had previously indulged in optimism. As for Castell, he confined himself to preparing his serums with the maximum of care. By this time, no public place or building had escaped conversion into a hospital or quarantine camp, with the exception of the prefect's offices, which were needed for administrative purposes and committee meetings. In a general way, however, owing to the relative stability of the epidemic at this time, Rieu's organizations were still able to cope with the situation. Though working constantly at high pressure, the doctors and their helpers weren't forced to contemplate still greater efforts. All they had to do was to carry on automatically, so to speak, their all but superhuman task. The pneumonic type of infection, cases of which had already been detected, was now spreading all over the town. One could almost believe that the high winds were kindling and fanning its flames in people's chests. The victims of pneumonic plague succumbed much more quickly, after coughing up blood-stained sputum. This new form of the epidemic looked as if it was more contagious as well as even more fatal. However, the opinions of experts had always been divided on this matter. For greater safety, all sanitary workers wore masks of sterilized muslin. On the face of it, the disease should have extended its ravages, but the cases of bubonic plague showing a decrease, the death rate remained constant. Meanwhile, the authorities had another cause for anxiety in the difficulty of maintaining the food supply. Profiteers were taking a hand and purveying at enormous prices essential foodstuffs not available in the shops. The result was that poor families were in great straits, while the rich went short of practically nothing. Thus, whereas plague, by its impartial ministrations, should have promoted equality among our townsfolk, it now had the opposite effect, and, thanks to the habitual conflict of cupidities, exacerbated the sense of injustice rankling in men's hearts. They were assured, of course, of the inerrable equality of death. But nobody wanted that kind of equality. Poor people who were feeling the pinch thought still more nostalgically of towns and villages in the nearby countryside, where bread was cheap and life without restrictions. Indeed, they had a natural, if illogical, feeling that they should have been permitted to move out to these happier places. The feeling was embodied in a slogan shouted in the streets and chalked up on walls: bread or fresh air. This half-ironical battle cry was the signal for some demonstrations that, though easily repressed, made everyone aware that an ugly mood was developing among us. The newspapers, needless to say, complied with the instructions given them. Optimism at all costs. If one was to believe what one read in them, our populace was giving a fine example of courage and composure. But in a town thrown back upon itself, in which nothing could be kept secret, no one had illusions about the example given by the public. To form a correct idea about the courage and composure talked about by our journalists, you had only to visit one of the quarantine depots or isolation camps established by our authorities. As it so happens, the narrator, being fully occupied elsewhere, had no occasion to visit any of them, and must fall back on Tarou's diary for a description of the conditions in these places. Tarou gives an account of a visit he made, accompanied by Rambert, to the camp located in the municipal stadium. The stadium lies on the outskirts of the town, between a street along which runs a car line, and a stretch of wasteland extending to the extreme edge of the plateau on which Oran is built. It was already surrounded by high concrete walls, and all that was needed to make escape practically impossible was to post sentries at the four entrance gates. The walls served another purpose. They screened the unfortunates in quarantine from the view of people on the road. Against this advantage may be set the fact that the inmates could hear all day, though they couldn't see them, the passing streetcars, and recognize by the increased volume of sound coming from the road the hours when people had knocked off work or were going to it. And this brought home to them that the life from which they were debarred was going on as before, within a few yards of them, and that those high walls parted two worlds as alien to each other as two different planets. Tarou and Rombert chose a Sunday afternoon for their visit to the stadium. They were accompanied by Gonzalez, the football player, with whom Rombert had kept in contact, and who had let himself be persuaded into undertaking, in rotation with others, the surveillance of the camp. This visit was to enable Rombert to introduce Gonzalez to the camp commandant. When they met that afternoon, Gonzalez's first remark was that this was exactly the time when, before the plague, he used to start getting into his football togs. Now that the sports fields had been requisitioned, all that was of the past, and Gonzalez was feeling, and showed it, at a loose end. This was one of the reasons why he had accepted the post proposed by Rombert, but he made it a condition that he was to be on duty during weekends only. The sky was overcast, and, glancing up at it, Gonzalez observed regretfully that a day like this, neither too hot nor rainy, would have been perfect for a game. And then he fell to conjuring up, as best he could, the once familiar smell of embrocation in the dressing rooms, the stands crowded with people, the colored shirts of the players showing up brightly against the tawny soil, the lemons at intermission or bottled lemonade that titillated parched throats with 1,000 refreshing pinpricks. Tarou also records how, on the way, as they walked the shabby outer streets, the footballer gave kicks to all the small loose stones. His object was to shoot them into the sewer holes of the gutters, and whenever he did this, he would shout, "Goal!" When he had finished his cigarette, he spat the stub in front of him and tried to catch it on his toe before it touched the ground. Some children were playing near the stadium, and when one of them sent a ball toward the three men, Gonzalez went out of his way to return it neatly. On entering the stadium, they found the stands full of people. The field was dotted with several hundred red tents, inside which one had glimpses of bedding and bundles of clothes or rugs. The stands had been kept open for the use of the internees in hot or rainy weather, but it was a rule of the camp that everyone must be in his tent at sunset. Shower baths had been installed under the stands, and what used to be the players' dressing rooms converted into offices and infirmaries. The majority of the inmates of the camp were sitting about on the stands. Some, however, were strolling on the touchlines, and a few, squatting at the entrances of their tents, were listlessly contemplating the scene around them. In the stands, many of those slumped on the wooden tiers had a look of vague expectancy. "What do they do with themselves all day?" Tarou asked Rombert. "Nothing." Almost all, indeed, had empty hands and idly dangling arms. Another curious thing about this multitude of derelicts was its silence. "When they first came, there was such a din you couldn't hear yourself speak," Rombert said. "But as the days went by, they grew quieter and quieter." In his notes, Tarou gives what, to his mind, would explain this change. He pictures them in the early days bundled together in the tents, listening to the buzz of flies, scratching themselves, and, whenever they found an obliging listener, shrilly voicing their fear or indignation. But when the camp grew overcrowded, fewer and fewer people were inclined to play the part of sympathetic listener. So they had no choice but to hold their peace and nurse their mistrust of everything and everyone. One had, indeed, a feeling that suspicion was falling, dew-like, from the grayly shining sky over the brick-red camp. Yes, there was suspicion in the eyes of all. Obviously, they were thinking, there must be some good reason for the isolation inflicted on them. And they had the air of people who are puzzling over their problem and are afraid. Everyone Taru set eyes on had that vacant gaze and was visibly suffering from the complete break with all that life had meant to him. And since they couldn't be thinking of their death all the time, they thought of nothing. They were on vacation. But worst of all, Taru writes, is that they're forgotten, and they know it. Their friends have forgotten them because they have other things to think about, naturally enough. And those they love have forgotten them because all their energies are devoted to making schemes and taking steps to get them out of the camp. And by dint of always thinking about these schemes and steps, they have ceased thinking about those whose release they're trying to secure. And that, too, is natural enough. In fact, it comes to this. Nobody is capable of really thinking about anyone, even in the worst calamity. For really to think about someone means thinking about that person every minute of the day, without letting one's thoughts be diverted by anything. By meals, by a fly that settles on one's cheek, by household duties, or by a sudden itch somewhere. But there are always flies and itches. That's why life is difficult to live. And these people know it only too well. The camp manager came up. A gentleman named Otón, he said, would like to see them. Leaving Gonzalez in the office, he led the others to a corner of the grandstand, where they saw Monsieur Otón sitting by himself. He rose as they approached. The magistrate was dressed exactly as in the past and still wore a stiff collar. The only changes Taru noted were that the tufts of hair over his temples weren't brushed back and that one of his shoelaces was undone. Monsieur Otón appeared very tired, and not once did he look his visitors in the face. He said he was glad to see them and requested them to thank Dr. Rieu for all he had done. Some moments of silence ensued. Then, with an effort, the magistrate spoke again. I hope Jacques didn't suffer too much. This was the first time Taru heard him utter his son's name, and he realized that something had changed. The sun was setting and, flooding through a rift in the clouds, the level rays raked the stands, tinging their faces with a yellow glow. No, Taru said. No, I couldn't really say he suffered. When they took their leave, the magistrate was still gazing toward the light. They called in at the office to say goodbye to Gonzalez, whom they found studying the duty roster. The footballer was laughing when he shook hands with them. Anyhow, I'm back in the good old dressing room, he chuckled. That's something to go on with. Soon after, when the camp manager was seeing Taru and Rambert out, they heard a crackling noise coming from the stands. A moment later, the loudspeakers, which in happier times served to announce the results of games or to introduce the teams, informed the inmates of the camp that they were to go back to their tents for the evening meal. Slowly, everyone filed off the stands and shuffled toward the tents. After all were under canvas, two small electric trucks, of the kind used for transporting baggage on railroad platforms, began to wend their way between the tents. While the occupants held forth their arms, two ladles plunged into the two big cauldrons on each truck and neatly tipped their contents into the waiting mess kits. Then the truck moved on to the next tent. "Very efficient," Taru remarked. The camp manager beamed as he shook hands. "Yes, isn't it? We're great believers in efficiency in this camp." Dusk was falling. The sky had cleared and the camp was bathed in cool, soft light. Through the hush of evening came a faint tinkle of spoons and plates. Above the tents, bats were circling, vanishing abruptly into the darkness. A streetcar squealed on a switch outside the walls. "Poor Monsieur Othon," Taru murmured as the gate closed behind them. "One would like to do something to help him. But how can you help a judge?" There were other camps of much the same kind in the town. But the narrator, for lack of first-hand information, and in deference to veracity, has nothing to add about them. This much, however, he can say. The mere existence of these camps, the smell of crowded humanity coming from them, the baying of their loudspeakers in the dusk, the air of mystery that clung about them, and the dread these forbidden places inspired, told seriously on our fellow citizens' morale, and added to the general nervousness and apprehension. Breaches of the peace and minor riots became more frequent. As November drew to a close, the mornings turned much colder. Heavy downpours had scoured the streets and washed the sky clean of clouds. In the mornings, a weak sunlight bathed the town in a cold, sparkling sheen. The air warmed up, however, as night approached. It was such a night that Taru chose for telling something of himself to Dr. Ryu. After a particularly tiring day, about 10 o'clock, Taru proposed to the doctor that they should go together for the evening visit to Ryu's old asthma patient. There was a soft glow above the housetops in the old town, and a light breeze fanned their faces at the street crossings. Coming from the silent streets, they found the old man's loquacity rather irksome at first. He launched into a long harangue to the effect that some folks were getting fed up, that it was always the same people had all the jam, and things couldn't go on like that indefinitely. One day there'd be, he rubbed his hands, a fine old row. He continued expatiating on this theme all the time the doctor was attending to him. They heard footsteps overhead. Noticing Taru's upward glance, the old woman explained that it was the girls from next door walking on the terrace. She added that one had a lovely view up there, and that as the terraces in this part of the town often joined up with the next one on one side, the women could visit their neighbors without having to go into the street. "Why not go up and have a look?" the old man suggested. "You'll get a breath of nice fresh air." They found nobody on the terrace, only 3 empty chairs. On one side, as far as eye could reach, was a row of terraces, the most remote of which abutted on a dark, rugged mass that they recognized as the hill nearest the town. On the other side, spanning some streets and the unseen harbor, their gaze came to rest on the horizon, where sea and sky merged in a dim, vibrant grayness. Beyond a black patch that they knew to be the cliffs, a sudden glow, whose source they couldn't see, sprang up at regular intervals. The lighthouse at the entrance of the fairway was still functioning for the benefit of ships that, passing Oran's unused harbor, went on to other ports along the coast. In a sky swept crystal clear by the night wind, the stars showed like silver flakes, tarnished now and then by the yellow gleam of the revolving light. Perfumes of spice and warm stone were wafted on the breeze. Everything was very still. A pleasant spot, said Rieu as he lowered himself into a chair. You'd think that plague had never found its way up here. Tarou was gazing seawards, his back to the doctor. Yes, he replied after a moment's silence. It's good to be here. Then, settling into the chair beside Rieu, he fixed his eyes on his face. Three times the glow spread up the sky and died away. A faint clatter of crockery rose from a room opening on the street below. A door banged somewhere in the house. Rieu? Tarou said in a quite ordinary tone. Do you realize that you've never tried to find out anything about me? The man I am? Can I regard you as a friend? Yes, of course we're friends. Only so far we haven't had much time to show it. Good. That gives me confidence. Suppose we now take an hour off. For friendship? Rieu smiled by way of answer. Well, here goes. There was a long, faint hiss some streets off. The sound of a car speeding on the wet pavement. It died away. Then some vague shouts a long way off broke the stillness again. Then, like a dense veil slowly falling from the starry sky on the two men, silence returned. Tarou had moved and now was sitting on the parapet, facing Rieu, who was slumped back in his chair. All that could be seen of him was a dark, bulky form outlined against the glimmering sky. He had much to tell. What follows gives it more or less in his own words. To make things simpler, Rieu, let me begin by saying I had plague already, long before I came to this town and encountered it here. Which is tantamount to saying, I'm like everybody else. Only there are some people who don't know it or feel at ease in that condition. Others know and want to get out of it. Personally, I've always wanted to get out of it. When I was young, I lived with the idea of my innocence. That's to say, with no idea at all. I'm not the self-tormenting kind of person, and I made a suitable start in life. I brought off everything I set my hand to. I moved at ease in the field of the intellect. I got on excellently with women. And if I had occasional qualms, they passed as lightly as they came. Then one day I started thinking. And now, I should tell you, I wasn't poor in my young days, as you were. My father had an important post. He was prosecuting attorney, but to look at him, you'd never have guessed it. He appeared and was a kindly, good-natured man. My mother was a simple, rather shy woman, and I've always loved her greatly. But I'd rather not talk about her. My father was always very kind to me. And I even think he tried to understand me. He wasn't a model husband. I know that now, but I can't say it shocks me particularly. Even in his infidelities, he behaved as one could count on his behaving, and never gave rise to scandal. In short, he wasn't at all original, and now he's dead, I realize that, while no plaster saint. He was a very decent man, as men go. He kept the middle way, that's all. He was the type of man for whom one has an affection of the mild but steady order, which is the kind that wears best. My father had one peculiarity. The big railway directory was his bedside book. Not that he often took a train. Almost his only journeys were to Brittany, where he had a small country house to which we went every summer. But he was a walking timetable. He could tell you the exact times of departure and arrival of the Paris-Berlin expresses. how to get from Lyon to Warsaw, which trains to take and at what hours. The precise distance between any two capital cities you might mention. Could you tell me offhand how to get from Briançon to Chamonix? Even a station master would scratch his head, I should say. Well, my father had the answer pat. Almost every evening, he enlarged his knowledge of the subject, and he prided himself on it. This hobby of his much amused me. I would put complicated travel problems to him and check his answers afterwards by the railway directory. They were invariably correct. My father and I got on together excellently, thanks largely to these railway games we played in the evenings. I was exactly the audience he needed, attentive and appreciative. Personally, I regarded this accomplishment of his as quite as admirable in its ways as most accomplishments. But I'm letting my tongue run away with me and attributing too much importance to that worthy man. Actually, he played only an indirect role in the great change of heart about which I want to tell you. The most he did to me was to touch off a train of thoughts. When I was 17, my father asked me to come to hear him speak in court. There was a big case on at the assizes, and probably he thought I'd see him to his best advantage. Also, I suspect, he hoped I'd be duly impressed by the pomp and ceremony of the law, and encouraged to take up his profession. I could tell he was keen on my going, and the prospect of seeing a side of my father's character so different from that we saw at home appealed to me. Those were absolutely the only reasons I had for going to the trial. What happened in a court had always seemed to me as natural, as much in the order of things, as a military parade on the 14th of July, or a school speech day. My notions on the subject were purely abstract, and I'd never given it serious thought. The only picture I carried away with me of that day's proceedings was a picture of the criminal. I've little doubt he was guilty. Of what crime is no great matter. That little man of about 30, with sparse sandy hair, seemed so eager to confess everything, so genuinely horrified at what he'd done and what was going to be done with him, that after a few minutes I had eyes for nothing and nobody else. He looked like a yellow owl scared blind by too much light. His tie was slightly awry. He kept biting his nails, those of one hand only, his right. I needn't go on, need I? You've understood. He was a living human being. As for me, it came on me suddenly in a flash of understanding. Until then, I thought of him only under his commonplace official designation, as the defendant. And though I can't say I quite forgot my father, something seemed to grip my vitals at that moment and riveted all my attention on the little man in the dock. I hardly heard what was being said. I only knew that they were set on killing that living man, and an uprush of some elemental instinct, like a wave, had swept me to his side. And I didn't really wake up until my father rose to address the court. In his red gown, he was another man. No longer genial or good-natured. His mouth spewed out long, turgid phrases like an endless stream of snakes. I realized he was clamoring for the prisoner's death, telling the jury that they owed it to society to find him guilty. He went so far as to demand that the man should have his head cut off. Not exactly in those words, I admit. He must pay the supreme penalty, was the formula. But the difference really was slight, and the result the same. He had the head he asked for. Only, of course, it wasn't he who did the actual job. I, who saw the whole business through to its conclusion, felt a far closer, far more terrifying intimacy with that wretched man than my father can ever have felt. Nevertheless, it fell to him, in the course of his duties, to be present at what's politely termed the prisoner's last moments, but what would be better called murder in its most despicable form. From that day on, I couldn't even see the railway directory without a shudder of disgust. I took a horrified interest in legal proceedings, death sentences, executions, and I realized, with dismay, that my father must have often witnessed those brutal murders. On the days when, as I'd noticed without guessing what it meant, he rose very early in the morning. I remembered he used to wind his alarm clock on those occasions to make sure. I didn't dare to broach the subject with my mother. But I watched her now more closely and saw that their life in common had ceased to mean anything. She had abandoned hope. That helped me to forgive her, as I put it to myself at the time. Later on, I learned that there'd been nothing to forgive. She'd been quite poor until her marriage, and poverty had taught her resignation. Probably you're expecting me to tell you that I left home at once. No, I stayed on many months, nearly a year, in fact. Then one evening my father asked for the alarm clock, as he had to get up early. I couldn't sleep that night. Next day, when he came home, I'd gone. To cut a long story short, I had a letter from my father, who had set inquiries on foot to find me. I went to see him and, without explaining my reasons, told him quite calmly that I'd kill myself if he forced me to return. He wound up by letting me have my way. He was, as I've said, a kindly man at bottom. Gave me a lecture on the silliness of wanting to live my life. That was how he accounted for my conduct, and I didn't undeceive him. And plenty of good advice. I could see he really felt it deeply, and it was an effort for him to keep back his tears. Subsequently, but quite a long time after that, I formed a habit of visiting my mother periodically, and I always saw him on these occasions. I imagine these infrequent meetings satisfied my father. Personally, I hadn't the least antipathy to him. Only a little sadness of heart. When he died, I had my mother come to live with me. And she'd still be with me if she were alive. I've had to dwell on my start in life, since for me it really was the start of everything. I'll get on more quickly now. I came to grips with poverty when I was 18. After an easy life till then. I tried all sorts of jobs, and I didn't do too badly. But my real interest in life was the death penalty. I wanted to square accounts with that poor blind owl in the dock. So I became an agitator, as they say. I didn't want to be pestiferous, that's all. To my mind, the social order around me was based on the death sentence. And by fighting the established order, I'd be fighting against murder. That was my view. Others had told me so. And I still think that this belief of mine was substantially true. I joined forces with a group of people I then liked, and indeed have never ceased to like. I spent many years in close cooperation with them, and there's not a country in Europe in whose struggles I haven't played a part. But that's another story. Needless to say, I knew that we, too, on occasion passed sentences of death. But I was told that these few deaths were inevitable for the building up of a new world in which murder would cease to be. That also was true up to a point. And maybe I'm not capable of standing fast where that order of truths is concerned. Whatever the explanation, I hesitated. But then I remembered that miserable owl in the dock, and it enabled me to keep on. Until the day when I was present at an execution, it wasn't hungry, and exactly the same dazed horror that I'd experienced as a youngster made everything real before my eyes. Have you ever seen a man shot by a firing squad? No, of course not. The spectators are hand-picked, and it's like a private party. You need an invitation. The result is that you've gleaned your ideas about it from books and pictures. A post, a blindfolded man, some soldiers in the offing. But the real thing isn't a bit like that. Do you know that the firing squad stands only a yard and a half from the condemned man? Do you know that if the victim took two steps forward, his chest would touch the rifles? Do you know that at this short range, the soldiers concentrate their fire on the region of the heart, and their bullets make a hole into which you could thrust your fist? No, you didn't know all that. Those are things that are never spoken of. For the plague stricken, their peace of mind is more important than a human life. Decent folks must be allowed to sleep easier nights, mustn't they? Really, it would be shockingly bad taste to linger on such details. That's common knowledge. But personally, I've never been able to sleep well since then. The bad taste remained in my mouth, and I've kept lingering on the details, brooding over them. And thus I came to understand that I, anyhow, had had plague through all those long years in which, paradoxically enough, I'd believed with all my soul that I was fighting it. I learned that I had had an indirect hand in the deaths of thousands of people. That I'd even brought about their deaths by approving of acts and principles which could only end that way. Others didn't seem embarrassed by such thoughts, or anyhow never voiced them of their own accord. But I was different. What I'd come to know stuck in my gorge. I was with them, and yet I was alone. When I spoke of these matters, they told me not to be so squeamish. I should remember what great issues were at stake. And they advanced arguments, often quite impressive ones, to make me swallow what nonetheless I couldn't bring myself to stomach. I replied that the most eminent of the plague-stricken, the men who wear red robes, also have excellent arguments to justify what they do. And once I admitted the arguments of necessity and force majeure put forward by the less eminent, I couldn't reject those of the eminent. To which they retorted that the surest way of playing the game of the red robes was to leave to them the monopoly of the death penalty. My reply to this was that if you gave in once, there was no reason for not continuing to give in. It seems to me that history has borne me out. Today there's a sort of competition who will kill the most. They're all mad over murder, and they couldn't stop killing men even if they wanted to. In any case, my concern wasn't with arguments. It was with the poor owl, with that foul procedure whereby dirty mouths, stinking of plague, told a fettered man that he was going to die, and scientifically arranged things so that he should die, after nights and nights of mental torture while he waited to be murdered in cold blood. My concern was with that hole in a man's chest. And I told myself that meanwhile, so far anyhow as I was concerned, nothing in the world would induce me to accept any argument that justified such butcheries. Yes, I chose to be blindly obstinate, pending the day when I could see my way more clearly. I'm still of the same mind. For many years I've been ashamed, mortally ashamed of having been, even with the best intentions, even at many removes, a murderer in my turn. As time went on, I merely learned that even those who were better than the rest couldn't keep themselves nowadays from killing or letting others kill, because such is the logic by which they live, and that we can't stir a finger in this world without the risk of bringing death to somebody. Yes, I've been ashamed ever since. I have realized that we all have plague, and I have lost my peace. And today I'm still trying to find it, still trying to understand all those others, and not to be the mortal enemy of anyone. I only know that one must do what one can to cease being plague-stricken. And that's the only way in which we can hope for some peace, or, failing that, a decent death. This, and only this, can bring relief to men and, if not save them, at least do them the least harm possible and even sometimes a little good. So that's why I resolved to have no truck with anything which, directly or indirectly, for good reasons or for bad, brings death to anyone or justifies others putting him to death. That, too, is why this epidemic has taught me nothing new, except that I must fight it at your side. I know positively. Yes, Rie, I can say I know the world inside out, as you may see. That each of us has the plague within him. No one. No one on earth is free from it. And I know, too, that we must keep endless watch on ourselves, lest in a careless moment we breathe in somebody's face and fasten the infection on him. What's natural is the microbe. All the rest, health, integrity, purity, if you like, is a product of the human will, of a vigilance that must never falter. The good man, the man who infects hardly anyone, is the man who has the fewest lapses of attention. And it needs tremendous willpower, a never-ending tension of the mind, to avoid such lapses. Yes, Rieu, it's a wearying business, being plague-stricken. But it's still more wearying to refuse to be it. That's why everybody in the world today looks so tired. Everyone is more or less sick of plague. But that's also why some of us, those who want to get the plague out of their systems, feel such desperate weariness. A weariness from which nothing remains to set us free except death. Pending that release, I know I have no place in the world of today. Once I definitely refused to kill, I doomed myself to an exile that can never end. I leave it to others to make history. I know, too, that I'm not qualified to pass judgment on those others. There's something lacking in my mental makeup, and its lack prevents me from being a rational murderer. So it's a deficiency, not a superiority. But as things are, I'm willing to be as I am. I've learned modesty. All I maintain is that on this earth there are pestilences and there are victims, and it's up to us, so far as possible, not to join forces with the pestilences. That may sound simple to the point of childishness. I can't judge if it's simple, but I know it's true. You see, I'd heard such quantities of arguments which very nearly turned my head and turned other people's heads enough to make them approve of murder, and I'd come to realize that all our troubles spring from our failure to use plain, clear-cut language. So I resolved always to speak and to act quite clearly, as this was the only way of setting myself on the right track. That's why I say there are pestilences and there are victims. No more than that. If by making that statement, I too become a carrier of the plague germ, at least I don't do it willfully. I try, in short, to be an innocent murderer. You see? I've no great ambitions. I grant we should add a third category. That of the true healers. But it's a fact one doesn't come across many of them. And anyhow, it must be a hard vocation. That's why I decided to take, in every predicament, the victim side, so as to reduce the damage done. Among them, I can at least try to discover how one attains to the third category. In other words, to peace. Taru was swinging his leg, tapping the terrace lightly with his heel as he concluded. After a short silence, the doctor raised himself a little in his chair and asked if Taru had an idea of the path to follow for attaining peace. Yes, he replied. The path of sympathy. Two ambulances were clanging in the distance. The dispersed shouts they had been hearing off and on drew together on the outskirts of the town, near the stony hill. And presently there was a sound like a gunshot. Then silence fell again. Rieu counted two flashes of the revolving light. The breeze freshened, and a gust coming from the sea filled the air for a moment with the smell of brine. And at the same time, they clearly heard the low sound of waves lapping the foot of the cliffs. It comes to this, Taru said almost casually. What interests me is learning how to become a saint. But you don't believe in God. Exactly. Can one be a saint without God? That's the problem. In fact, the only problem I'm up against today. A sudden blaze sprang up above the place the shouts had come from, and stemming the wind stream, a rumor of many voices came to their ears. The blaze died down almost at once, leaving behind it only a dull red glow. Then, in a break of the wind, they distinctly heard some strident yells and the discharge of a gun, followed by the roar of an angry crowd. Taru stood up and listened, but nothing more could be heard. Another skirmish at the gates, I suppose. Well, it's over now, Rieu said. Taru said in a low voice that it was never over, and there would be more victims, because that was in the order of things. Perhaps, the doctor answered. But you know, I feel more fellowship with the defeated than with saints. Heroism and sanctity don't really appeal to me, I imagine. What interests me is being a man. Yes, we're both after the same thing. But I'm less ambitious. Rieu supposed Taru was jesting, and turned to him with a smile. But faintly lit by the dim radiance falling from the sky, the face he saw was sad and earnest. There was another gust of wind, and Rieu felt it warm on his skin. Taru gave himself a little shake. Do you know, he said, what we now should do for friendship's sake? Anything you like, Taru. Go for a swim. It's one of these harmless pleasures that even a saint-to-be can indulge in, don't you agree? Rieu smiled again, and Taru continued. With our passes, we can get out on the pier. Really, it's too damn silly living only in and for the plague. Of course, a man should fight for the victims. But if he ceases caring for anything outside that, what's the use of his fighting? Right, Rhea said. Let's go. Some minutes later, the car drew up at the harbor gates. The moon had risen, and a milk-white radiance, dappled with shadows, lay around them. Behind them rose the town, tier on tier, and from it came warm, fetid breaths of air that urged them toward the sea. After showing their passes to a guard, who inspected them minutely, they crossed some open ground littered with casks and headed toward the pier. The air here reeked of stale wine and fish. Just before they reached the pier, a smell of iodine and seaweed announced the nearness of the sea, and they clearly heard the sound of waves breaking gently on the big stone blocks. Once they were on the pier, they saw the sea spread out before them, a gently heaving expanse of deep-piled velvet, supple and sleek as a creature of the wild. They sat down on a boulder facing the open. Slowly the waters rose and sank, and with their tranquil breathing, sudden oily glints formed and flickered over the surface in a haze of broken lights. Before them, the darkness stretched out into infinity. Rhea could feel under his hand the gnarled, weather-worn visage of the rocks, and a strange happiness possessed him. Turning to Taru, he caught a glimpse on his friend's face of the same happiness, a happiness that forgot nothing, not even murder. They undressed, and Rhea dived in first. After the first shock of cold had passed and he came back to the surface, the water seemed tepid. When he had taken a few strokes, he found that the sea was warm that night with the warmth of autumn seas that borrow from the shore the accumulated heat of the long days of summer. The movement of his feet left a foaming wake as he swam steadily ahead, and the water slipped along his arms to close in tightly on his legs. A loud splash told him that Taru had dived. Rhea lay on his back and stayed motionless, gazing up at the dome of sky lit by the stars and moon. He drew a deep breath. Then he heard a sound of beaten water, louder and louder, amazingly clear in the hollow silence of the night. Taru was coming up with him. He now could hear his breathing. Rhea turned and swam level with his friend, timing his stroke to Taru's. But Taru was the stronger swimmer, and Rhea had to put on speed to keep up with him. For some minutes they swam side by side, with the same zest, in the same rhythm, isolated from the world, at last free of the town and of the plague. Rhea was the first to stop, and they swam back slowly. Except at one point where unexpectedly they found themselves caught in an ice-cold current. Their energy whipped up by this trap the sea had sprung on them, both struck out more vigorously. They dressed and started back. Neither had said a word, but they were conscious of being perfectly at one, and the memory of this night would be cherished by them both. When they caught sight of the plague watchman, Rhea guessed that Taru, like himself, was thinking that the disease had given them a respite, and this was good. But now they must set their shoulders to the wheel again. Yes, the plague gave short shrift indeed, and they must set their shoulders to the wheel again. Throughout December it smoldered in the chests of our townspeople, fed the fires in the crematorium, and peopled the camps with human jetsam. In short, it never ceased progressing with its characteristically jerky but unfaltering stride. The authorities had optimistically reckoned on the coming of winter to halt its progress. But it lasted through the first cold spells without the least remission. So the only thing for us to do was to go on waiting, And since after a too long waiting, one gives up waiting, the whole